Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. Our annual Strickland Lecturer in History at MTSU will be Dr. George Herring, Professor Emeritus at the University of Kentucky. He is considered one of the nation's foremost experts on the Vietnam War. His most recent work is From Colony to Superpower, American Foreign Relations Since 1776. We will talk with Dr. Herring about the war that won't go away after this from MTSUnews.com.
Here are a few of the stories now on MTSUnews.com, the university's news and information website. MTSU students came together October 10th to spruce up a section of campus while also protecting the community's drinking water. Coordinated by the MTSU Stormwater Program, the cleanup focused on grassy areas around the university's detention ponds on Rutherford Boulevard near Greek Row. Employees for Turner Construction Co. raised the first beams on MTSU's new $147 million science building October 11th. The new building will provide more than 250,000 gross square feet of teaching, faculty, and student research laboratories. Spring 2015 is the expected completion date for the project. And nearly 100 academically talented prospective MTSU students attended the True Blue Experience Day on October 5th. During the day, they not only toured campus, but also visited the university's housing and residential life facilities. For MTSU News Anytime, go to MTSUnews.com.
Dr. Herring, welcome. Thanks for being with us on MTSU on the Record today.
It's a pleasure.
The subject matter seems to resonate with just about everyone of a certain age. However, it resonates with different Americans in different ways. Why are we, in the aggregate, as a citizenry, still so conflicted about the Vietnam War after all this time?
I think the most obvious reason is that we were very conflicted about the war during the whole time it was fought. The Vietnam generation is a very prominent generation in terms of where they are now. That generation is still divided, and I think the country, they remember a time of division, and we're still very divided about it. Some of the issues that still divided us with Vietnam still divided us today, the foremost issue being, of course, when and where and how we should send military forces abroad, and when they're there, what should they be doing. From the time the war ended in 1975, these issues surfaced in Central America in the 80s, they surfaced in the Balkans in the 90s, they surfaced with the Iraq War, they surfaced with the war in Afghanistan. And in each of these cases, every time these issues came up, Vietnam came up, Vietnam sort of framed the discussion, and the same sort of divisions that took place during Vietnam were evident again with these problems later on.
When I was in college in the 70s, I saw a documentary called Hearts and Minds. And one of the so-called best and the brightest, as reporter David Halberstam referred to them, made a statement that the Vietnamese don't process grief the same way we do. This is a rough paraphrase. They're more stoic about it. They don't feel the same way we do. And they cut from that, the director did, straight to the scene of a woman who was so grief-stricken over the loss of her son, a Vietnamese woman, that she tried to climb down into the grave and be buried with him. We really never knew the Vietnamese. We never really understood what they were all about, did we?
First, I remember that scene very vividly. It's one of maybe a half dozen scenes in that film that really grip you. And actually, it was General Westmoreland who was Johnson's top military advisor.
I stand corrected. Thank you.
There was sort of a perception on the part of Americans that where we took human life very seriously, there's so many Asians, and they have a whole different perspective on that. And sacrifice of hundreds of thousands of people, and that's not the way we were. In fact, I traveled to Vietnam in the summer of 1997 with Robert McNamara, who was Secretary of Defense during the Kennedy and Johnson years, and he said in public appearances in Hanoi two or three times, he made statements that, if not quite as blatant as Westmoreland's statement, sort of expressed the same sentiment. And it may be true that the Vietnamese leaders, particularly Lê Duẩn, who was the top leader during the American War, were willing to do whatever was necessary to prevail in that war. And that was certainly true. And certainly on the other side, Johnson and Nixon and Kennedy and all of them were sensitive. They were very worried about growing casualties on our side. But that certainly doesn't take into account how parents felt about their children in Vietnam. They felt very much the same way as they do here. And so I think that statement, as it emerged out of Westmoreland's lips and as it emerged from McNamara's, reflected some fundamental misunderstandings, I think, of our adversary. And you're absolutely right. I think we did not understand the conflict we were getting into on a large scale in 1965. We didn't understand its origins. We didn't understand the people we were dealing with. We knew very little, if anything, about their history. I think that was one of the major reasons why we had such a difficult time there.
We'll be back with more in just a moment. This is MTSU on the Record.
Women in Science and Engineering, or WISE, helps college women prepare for and become involved in science-related careers. WISE nurtures women's interest in these fascinating and critical fields and provides mentoring and networking opportunities. The group's main goal is to assure women of their importance in all scientific and technical fields and to promote equal opportunity and treatment of women in science. I'm Dr. Judith Iriarte-Gross, WISE advisor.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
I'm Jenna Logue, and we're talking today with Dr. George Herring, Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Kentucky and the 2012 Strickland Lecturer in History. You mentioned Robert McNamara, who takes a lot of the heat for our performance in Vietnam. McNamara seemed to be trying to run the war the same way he ran the Ford Motor Company, it seemed to me. You can't run an assembly line war. But if he felt conflicted inside about the way the war was going, why didn't he not be more vocal about expressing his qualms to LBJ? Was he afraid of President Johnson?
That's a fascinating question that I don't know anybody will ever have a satisfactory answer to. To begin with, McNamara emerges out of the war as he does bring people together. He's somebody that both people who were strongly for the war and strongly against the war came to thoroughly dislike. He concluded as early as the latter part of 1965, which was shortly after the United States had sent large numbers of combat troops for the first time, that the war probably wasn't winnable. For some months, he kept this from Johnson. He didn't stand on this and take the position in cabinet meetings and elsewhere that this is a war we can't win, so we need to try to find a way out. He did take that position in March of 1967, and again in the fall of 1967, very firmly with Johnson. But he didn't really push it. He claimed that his in explaining it, he claimed that his first loyalty was to the president who appointed him, whereas other folks might have claimed that their first loyalty was to acting on principle or acting on what they saw as the truth or the like. It's not that he was not committed to the war, but he had come to conclude that the war wasn't winnable, and he had made some enemies in the military. He's a very difficult man to get along with, for one thing. He was arrogant. He was very sharp-tongued. He thought he was smarter than pretty much everybody else, and that sort of attitude doesn't sell any better in Washington than anywhere else. But essentially, he explained it as a matter of loyalty, and his loyalty was to the president that appointed him. And once that, it was pretty clear that he was not fully supportive of the policies, then the president arranged for him to take another job. But even then, of course, when he left office, he didn't come out and say, he said, what, 30 years after the war really escalated in 1965, in his memoir in 1995, he said, "We were wrong, terribly wrong." That's something he didn't say internally in the Johnson councils. When he left office in 1968, it's not something he said. You can imagine the impact if, upon leaving office, he had written the sort of statement that he wrote in 1995, but he refused to do it. He would not. Those of us, including myself, who wanted to interview him to get his fix on things, to learn his side of the war, he would not see us. He would not talk about the war until finally he confronted it in the early 90s, wrote his memoir, and then took several very interesting trips to Vietnam to try to answer some of the questions that still perplexed him. There's no question he agonized over it. Johnson, by 1967, I think, thought he might be on the verge of what was then called a nervous breakdown. McNamara might be, because he was so agonized on it.
I don't mean to approach this from a sort of great men of history mentality. It's much larger than the individuals who participated in it. But I did watch online a lecture you gave at Washington and Lee University about 3 years ago, and you gave characterizations of General William Westmoreland and General Creighton Abrams, who were about as different as night and day.
They really were. Fascinating comparison, yeah.
Well, can you talk about the difference in their leadership or management styles and how that might have had an impact on the war?
Their personalities, of course, were so different. General Westmoreland was, sort of your stereotypical general, very dressed to the nines, always looking perfect in his appearance, straightforward. Abrams was rumpled, usually chomping on a cigar, an insomniac who often put himself to sleep, or what little sleep he got, resting in an easy chair with a bottle of scotch and Wagner's operas, which is a crazy combination. But Abrams was more of a soldier's general. I think he was more at ease with himself and more at ease with the troops. I think it's easy to exaggerate the difference in approaches to the war. There are people, scholars and military analysts, who argue that had Abrams been in Westmoreland's post in 1964-65, the war might have been fought differently. I think mainly the argument here is that Abrams might have paid more attention to counterinsurgency and pacification and less attention to large-scale search-and-destroy operations of the sort that Westmoreland Brown did, and that would have worked better. There even a group who were some of the people who framed the new counterinsurgency strategy for both Iraq and Afghanistan, that's in the last 10 years, who sort of singled out Abrams and argued that what he did between 68 and 73 enjoyed enormous success, and that if he had done it earlier, the war might have been won. I'm not convinced of that, and a lot of people aren't convinced with that. I think it's easy to exaggerate the differences between what Ms. Moreland did and what Abrams did. It's also easy to exaggerate the success Abrams enjoyed. The point of that lecture, and the point that I always try to get people to think about in dealing with this issue, is less the question of why we failed, which being Americans, we have focused on in a very ethnocentric way. I think the question that we really maybe need to look at is why the other side succeeded as well as they did, and what did they do that is responsible for their ultimate success, or maybe the more comprehensive question of why did the war end up as it did.
And we'll examine that question of what the Vietnamese did right after this message. This is MTSU on the record.
The Middle East-centered MTSU seeks to promote greater understanding of the politics, history, and culture of this vitally important region of the world. Its mission includes the promotion of outreach programs and faculty research. The center sponsors lectures by Middle East experts and scholarly exchanges. We're especially pleased to offer a new interdisciplinary minor in Middle East Studies with courses in Arabic and Hebrew. This is Dr. Alan Hibbard, Center Director.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
Dr. George C. Herring is Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Kentucky. We're talking to him via telephone from his home in Lexington, Kentucky, and he will be our Strickland Lecturer in History. It seems almost as far as military technique is concerned, since the Vietnamese were intimately familiar with their own topography, that even though what we talk about today as terrorism, international terrorism, as asymmetrical warfare, because it involves these cells connecting with one another in a very loose-knit way instead of an actual nation-state, even though the Vietnam War was fought in a nation-state, it still seems like it fits the definition of asymmetrical warfare in a way.
It is a different kind. That's a very good point, and I think the term fits. It's asymmetrical in the principal way it's asymmetrical, I think, is in the stakes. One of the questions McNamara always asked in Vietnam was, well, why were you willing to sacrifice everything? And that's something he couldn't grasp. For them, for the people who led the revolution in 1945, who fought the war against the French from 1946 to 54, and who led the war against the United States from wherever you want to date it, 1961 or 1964 to 1975, they all, from the very beginning in 1945, the goals were to unify the country and free it of foreign influence. And this was a goal that they pursued with dogged determination for almost 30 years. It was a goal to which they were fanatically committed. It was their country. And I think that's the reason that they are willing to invest everything in it. And they're willing to fight to the last person if that's what's necessary. For us, the stakes were sort of amorphous. The stakes were in the realm of abstract ideas like containment and credibility and things like that. And it was very hard to persuade Americans, I think, those eventually who were fighting over there and those here that the stakes were sufficiently high to merit the cost we were paying. There, you know, people have a lot of different theories on why public opposition to the war developed as it did and why it became so strong. One of the reasons the opposition grows significantly after 1967 is the cost we're paying. Our body count has increased dramatically. It's late 1967 that Lyndon Johnson asked for a tax increase, and these two things, the cost in blood and treasure, were reaching the point where Americans were asking, well, you know, why are we paying this? Or they're asking the other question, why aren't we doing better than we are? Why aren't we making greater progress? And so your use of the word asymmetrical, I think, is quite right. We're fighting for one thing, and the Vietnamese are fighting for what they see. They're fighting for the preservation of their country and their very lives.
It seems to me also that the nature of the opposition to the war changed greatly at the point at which the middle class got upset about it. It was easy at first to dismiss people who were against the war as a bunch of lazy do-gooder hippies who didn't understand fully what America was all about. And then when it became clear that it wasn't just being fought by the poor kids who went into the military because they didn't have the skills to do anything else domestically, and we still had the draft during the Vietnam War, a lot more middle-class youngsters started coming home in coffins, and then people like Donna Reed, another Mother for Peace, who represented the middle class and the image of wholesome American suburban values, got involved in anti-war expressions, and she was married to a military man. Then America started to think, well, maybe there's something to the anti-war movement.
Well, there are two things here. Yes, I think you're right. The anti-war movement is many different things. It's kids protesting in the streets. It's teach-ins on campus. It's civil disobedience, but it's also, as you suggested, it's also other people who don't go out into the streets who, in time, begin to conclude that the war is either wrong or it's unwinnable, or perhaps both. You see a very different sort of person, for example, in the demonstrations, the moratorium demonstrations in, say, November 1969, than you do from the people who march on the Pentagon in 1967. But you also have another phenomenon going, and that is people who eventually conclude that if we're not going to win this war, why are we fighting it? These may be people who fully support the purposes of the war, but if Presidents Johnson and Nixon are not going to try to win it, then why are we continuing to spend lives? And so I think there are a number of different things at work here. It's a very complex phenomenon.
We'll take one more brief break. We'll be back with more on MTSU on the Record after this.
Specialized training in forensic science prepares tomorrow's professionals through the Forensic Institute for Research and Education, or FIRE. The Forensic Anthropology Search and Recovery Team assists law enforcement with skeletal remains at crime scenes. Legendary forensic scientists provide lectures free to the public, and high school students work realistic crime scenes each summer at our CSI MTSU camp. I'm Dr. Hugh Berryman, Director of FIRE.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
In our final moments with Dr. George C. Herring, who is MTSU's Strickland Lecturer in History, with regard to Iraq, a great many people compare it to Vietnam. Is that a fair comparison?
There were lots of comparisons. There are books, articles. One of my students wrote a very good book comparing the two situations. what you have to understand about interventions in other countries is that local conditions, local circumstances are always going to be different, and they're always going to have a huge impact on outcomes. Vietnam was unique, and its uniqueness had a lot to do with how it came out. Iraq was unique also, and that had a lot to do with the way it came out. We went into both sort of blindly confident that a show of force on our part would bring a solution. In neither case, of course, did that happen, and maybe that's the really haunting similarity. How could we do the same thing like that in the same way within a period of 30-some-odd years?
Did the Vietnam War and the Iraq War help to throw a kink into this belief that is loosely referred to as American exceptionalism?
This is an issue in this year's campaign, so it may have thrown a chink in it, but it's something that that many people and many politicians still believe in very strongly.
We Americans, in short, still think we're the toughest kids on the block, don't we?
Well, if not the toughest, certainly the best, yeah. It's very deeply embedded. It goes back to 1776. It's very deeply embedded in our national character.
It's ironic you should mention 1776, because one of the reasons you give for the war going the way that it did was our failure to recognize the value of history. It seems to me that with Vietnam, we failed to remember the lessons of our own revolution, that a bunch of poorly fed, poorly clothed rebels can upend one of the world's great superpowers.
Sometime between 1945 and 1949, when Ho Chi Minh, the leader of Vietnam, was trying to get American support, or at least get the United States not to support the French in that war, he referred to those ragtag American farmers and in trying to make clear to Americans that his movement was both on the side of history and that it had a good chance of success. Part of the reason we were intervening was to keep China from expanding in its influence in Vietnam, and I think that ignored the fact that Vietnam, through over 1,000 years of its existence, had fought the Chinese using some of the same tactics and techniques that it used against both the French and the United States, and that while Vietnam borrowed a lot from China in terms of language, culture, institutions, and the like, the Vietnamese fought the Chinese fiercely and ingeniously over a period of 1,000 years.
Dr. Herring, thank you for being our guest today on MTSU On the Record, and we look forward to your appearance on campus on October 25th and your very cogent and even-handed analysis of this pivotal event in American history.
Thank you very much, and I look forward to being there.
MTSU On the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, mtsunews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at mtsunews.com and on iTunes.